Hello, and welcome to the Ted Brower Show. This is your host, Austin Brower. Ted is actually getting prepped for the Hagman Show tonight. If you guys listened to the show yesterday, he's going to be on the show with Hagman the entire time from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So he's actually up in Tallahassee right now getting prepped for that. He's going to do the show tonight, and then he's going to go to the Florida State game on Saturday. So that should be pretty fun. So I definitely want to encourage you guys to tune in. I know the Hagman listeners a lot of times listen to our show, too. It's going to be a great show. He's got quite a bit of interesting stuff to talk about. And then he's going to be back on the Hagman Show again next Friday. So it should be a pretty fun week, pretty good month for everybody. Starting off, first thing I wanted to go into was the silver report for this week. Spot is about 1425 today, and gold's been at about 1082. It's dropped off. They've definitely shorted the market pretty hard this week. So I found premiums to be as low as $3.25 on a tube on eBay right now. I think a couple of the companies you can get a tube for about $350. And I always encourage people, man, buy some silver. And it's not, don't buy silver to try and make money. I always tell people that. If you're trying to buy silver to make money, don't worry about it. If it goes up high, that's awesome. If it doesn't, the main thing about silver is the wealth and asset preservation in the future as the dollar starts to collapse. Because we know, I mean, with 100 years since the Federal Reserve has been enacted in 1913, 102 years now, you can see our dollar has pretty much lost about 100% of its value. So silver and gold are definitely the best options. And on top of that, we're starting to see that the silver production is going up, but the actual physical mining is not reaching that. The U.S. Mint is actually starting to buy outside industrial silver now just to make silver eagles. The report that came out, the domestic mine, whereas now they're having to import silver just to cover the consumption of their official coin production, the estimated domestic supply for the United States this year was about 37 million ounces. The estimated total of silver eagle sales just this year is going to be around 50 million ounces. And the issue with that is that's going to be pushing close to a 15 million ounce deficit if they're going to have to, you know, acquire more silver. And a lot of people don't understand is that a lot of the silver on the paper and trading market, less than about 10% of it ever settles in physical metals. It usually is just bought out with more paper. And so you would see, you know, you figure if we are looking at a 15 million ounce deficit this year in eagles, if that was actually settled out in paper, you'd be looking at about 150 million ounces deficit for the U.S. mine, which is a pretty serious number. And that would obviously be just in eagles, but about five times more than what we mine in the U.S. So we definitely, we're starting to see a serious trend with this as far as silver. People are buying it up by the truckloads now and stockpiling it because they know it's one of the best wealth preservation metals ever in existence. Other news as well, we're also with the economy in shambles, a new article came out, more Americans are turning to squatting. There has always been squatters, but the trend may be rising. The phenomenon was notable in the 2006 housing bubble, but it is starting to resurface in strikingly similar circumstances now. And News 8 in Tampa, which is about 30 minutes west from us, reported on the reaction by law enforcement to squatters. It believes they may be using a manual that's sold on Amazon.com of strategies about how to squat. And what's kind of weird is if you look at the article from Tampa, it's a pretty weird, lopsided report, and it basically demonizes squatters as arrogant criminals who need to be busted for their crimes. Now, let me say something here. I don't think that it's right for people to go out of their way and break into houses and try and squat on places that are not theirs. But a lot of these individuals that were in these houses were financed houses that they should never have been able to afford. And the bank knew that when they gave them the loan and when they basically signed the paper on it. We saw this a lot locally where people were, you know, financing these 3,000-4,000 square foot houses for, you know, $1,000 a month, and they were making $35,000 a year. Well, then all of a sudden, after 2 or 3 years, the bubble, the whole thing went up, and so their payments went from $1,000 a month to $3,500 a month. Well, there's no way you can physically pay for that on that kind of income. And it's funny because I had a real good friend of mine, Josh, who rented a house in Lakeland while we were both over there at Southeastern. And, man, he always took care of the place, always paid the lady on time. She owned the house. She had a mortgage on it. She was renting it to him for like $950 a month. Well, in 2000, about the end of 2008, beginning of 2009, he was notified by the owner. She basically told him, she said, hey, I'm done making payments on the house. They've literally tripled. I can't afford it. I'm going to let it roll into foreclosure. You're renting there. You have legal renting rights there. You've been there for, you know, about a year now. Stay there as long as you want until they boot you out. And it's funny because he stayed there, and we were talking about it a couple months ago when I saw him. We were laughing about it because he went back and forth with the bank. They contacted him, sent him papers back and forth, and finally they offered to pay him $2,000 if he would move out within 30 days the end of last year. So he lived there for almost 5 years rent-free, and we joked about it a lot of times. I said, it's going to be funny. I said, they make a mistake. Said one day they're probably just going to send the deed in the mail to you and the house is going to be yours, but that didn't happen. But it's just interesting to see because, I mean, you know, he took really good care of the place, and what nobody understands is we're starting to see these houses locally as well. When they foreclose on these people and they evict them and boot them out, the houses are empty. The AC compressors start drying up. All the copper usually gets stripped out of the attic by vandals. The yards start growing up 2-3 feet because nobody will mow it. The banks won't pay to mow it. The neighbors, usually, in our cases, we've been having to mow other people's properties that are foreclosed on and evicted where they're completely vacant. And so I mean, it makes sense if nobody's going to live there, nobody's paying money regardless. If somebody's taking care of the house, keeping it upkept and maintained, let them live there. It doesn't matter. They're not considered criminals for that. People are having hard times, and we need to do the best we can in America, especially for, you know, law-abiding Americans that are trying to do their best. We need to help them out. And another Obamacare failure, which, surprise, surprise, a total of $1.2 billion in federal taxpayer dollars have been sunk into 23 co-ops created under Obamacare. Now, 12 of those co-ops have now gone completely out of business, representing another Obamacare failure. And Representative Chris Collins out of New York, Republican, he said, this is a setup for failure from day one. We're here because Obamacare was set up for failure. It was set up to encourage low premiums to deceive the American public. That everybody knew these products were underpriced and they were going up and it was going to be on the back of the taxpayers, and that's why we're here today. And essentially that's what's going on. You know, we had to get insurance for Lana now because she's, you know, my wife. She's pregnant with our first child. And it's crazy, you know, just her alone for a basic plan is almost $400 a month, and it still has, you know, co-pays, premiums, deductibles. I think our max out-of-pocket is close to $10,000, and, you know, it's insane because I don't even know what I'm getting for $400 a month. And the guy that was talking to us, you know, that we were talking about the insurance, that was the best rate we could pretty much find right now. He had another one in there that was $780 a month for just Lana, and I asked him, I said, what in the world is this cover? He's like, well, you know, it pretty much decreases your copay down to $500 for emergency rooms, stuff like that, and you don't have a deductible. And I was like, okay, well, give us a quote, you know, on her and I and a child, basically once he's here next year, just, you know, for giggles. And he comes back and he's like, well, if you want that plan for all three of you, it's going to be $1,910 a month. And I started laughing. I said, $2,000 a month for insurance? $24,000 a year? Are you joking me right now? Like, how in the world is any family even supposed to pay for that? And it's the whole thing with the insurance and the health insurance is a giant scam. It's been set up as a scam. Obamacare was just furthering it, making it even more of a scam. And it's just, we see it over and over again with the government intrusion in our lives. Now, like, I think next year it's $695 to the penalty on your income tax return if you don't have health insurance, which is still much cheaper than, you know, $400 a month for insurance. So we'll see how it goes. Another article came out now that's pretty interesting on civil asset forfeiture. I like to remind a lot of people about this because this is a very, very serious problem we're starting to see in the United States. Starting in back in about 2001, after 9/11 and the Patriot Act was implemented. We had basically what the government came in and did is if you're involved in anything, if you were thought to be doing anything illegal, if you were structuring bank transactions, if you were selling drugs, if you were involved in something that they thought was criminal, they basically seize all of your assets, all of them, house, cars, toys, money, bank accounts. And it's happened repeatedly, and I've watched it happen here in Florida. It's really bad about it. And it doesn't even matter. Somebody can get busted for, you know, having a quarter pound of marijuana on them, you know, which is a couple hundred dollars down here in Florida. And they get busted, and all their vehicles get seized, and their house gets seized. And they say, well, you could have bought all this stuff with drug money. And the issue that it goes on is that there's no accountability with this. And in Texas was actually the worst state, I think, they came up with. Yeah, Texas had over $46 million just in assets from local police forfeited. In 2012, the Department of Justice and Treasury combined seized over $3 billion in combined net assets. By 2004, forfeitures had ballooned to nearly $4.5 billion. And one of the biggest things that they said was that they were getting people on structuring. Structuring is basically one of the main ways that a lot of people end up victims of forfeiture. It involves purposely keeping transactions from surpassing a certain threshold so they do not require banks to make a record of them or file a report regarding a possible suspicious operation. The problem with this is about 80 to 90% of people that have done this, we're not doing it for any type of serious crime or any type of, you know, insidious reason. They basically were doing it to try and prevent paying more taxes to the government or paying more that year and to offset them till next year. Under, I think, normal bank laws right now, you can't deposit more than $9,999 in cash without declaring where you got it from. So this is how easy it is to get busted for structuring. You're operating, say, a restaurant. This has happened, actually. It's happened in Texas and it happened in Florida. The owner goes in, deposits $2,000 in his account from the restaurant on Monday. He goes back in Friday, deposits another $3,000 in his account. Then the next week, he empties out his cash register, had a great week, deposits $6,000 in his account. Well, now he just deposited $11,000 over a week and a half. And it's not, there's no specific law about structuring. That's the problem with it. So he just deposited $11,000 in a week and a half. Bam, he gets arrested for structuring. They seized his entire account that had $180,000 in it, and they wouldn't give it back to him. And the problem is these forfeitures are incentivized now. The law enforcement agencies are allowed to keep some, if not all, of what they seize. And civil forfeiture laws permit, if not encourage, law enforcement to police for profit, and agencies have responded with zeal. Civil forfeitures pose serious risk to property and due process rights. Listen to this. At least 45% of forfeiture proceeds are directed to law enforcement funds in 43 states, while half the other states and the federal government allocate up to 100% of the seized funds to police. The money can usually be spent at the agency's discretion with very little oversight. And they even interviewed M. Burton, who is in a department, and they refer to it as toys for police. And it's usually based on a need. Well, we'll take that back. There's very few limitations on it. And the worst problem is what everybody's forgetting, why it's so devastating, is they're making these people required to prove their innocence in order to recover their property. Understand, guys, that is not how our judicial system was built or is designed to function. It is supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. They're seizing these people's assets, forcing them to get an attorney, going to court, spending months and months, tens of thousands of dollars, just to get their assets back to prove that they were innocent. So this is a serious issue. And I mean, we've raised it up in our, you know, county commissioners, sheriff, I mean, everything around here. We've brought it up a lot. And I encourage anybody that knows anything about this or has heard about it, definitely bring it up. Bring it up to your congressman. Bring it up to your elected officials, your county commissioners. This is a serious problem. I understand the concept of it when we have very serious crimes that are involving lots of money and murder and all this other stuff that's engulfed in it and stuff gets seized. I understand that. But the problem is there's no limitations on it anymore. They pull you over and you have $15,000 in cash because you're about to go buy a new motorcycle from a private seller up in Jacksonville. You get arrested. They seize all your money. You can't even get it back. They say, well, you were probably planning on buying drugs with it. I've watched that happen before. It's absolute nightmare. And another topic that I always love touching on, we got a few different articles here. Weapons, firearms. The UCA law professor, Adam Winkler, stated in an article this week in a report with Guns America, assault weapons bans don't reduce any crime at all. And what's funny is that a lot of people discuss national confiscation, weapons confiscation, and let me say right now, it would be an extreme rarity for a national ban or gun confiscation to be executive ordered. It would be very difficult to even implement, much less even write that in law. I mean, it would more than likely start a second Revolutionary War, whether they wanted to or not. It would just not be beneficial for anybody in the country, including the Democrats. But what's interesting is there's usually, in every country from what we've seen, there's usually about three main factors that always start to build, and that basically three steps that they go through before complete and total gun confiscation. Now, before everybody gets all mad at me and says, oh, well, you know, they're not going to ban weapons, they're not going to confiscate weapons, they've already done it repeatedly in the United States. It just doesn't get very much publicity because it's usually very small incidences. We've already seen almost every other industrialized country in the world has been pretty much disarmed. And underneath the New York State Safe Act, what they added in there was they broadened the definition of assault weapon to include more commonly owned and widely populated firearms. They require everyone to register it with the government. And the last one that I love, they prevent any future transfers of those weapons so that once the owner dies, they can no longer be legal for anyone else to possess. This is what's referred to as drying up the supply. This is the first step in gun confiscation. They're already doing it in New York. They've already implemented this in a lot of other states. So what it does is it doesn't necessarily just outright ban these weapons. Well, they did ban the assault weapons in New York. That's already been done. But even if you have other weapons, you have to register them, and then once you die, you can't pass them on to your children. So now your children or your grandkids are in possession of felony weapons that they essentially either have to flee the state with, or they have to turn them into the government and have them destroyed. And it's really interesting. But make no mistake, it's not really just a ban. It is a confiscation over the long haul. The exact same thing they did with the 1986 Firearm Safety Bill that Reagan signed in the passing. So I have no idea why he even authorized that. I don't think he really knew what he was signing. What it did was it prevented all American civilians from possessing or manufacturing any type of machine guns built or made after 1986. And what it did is it made the supply, now the only things you can possess with a $200 tax stamp through the ATF with machine guns is pre-86 weapons. Well, the problem is there was only a specific amount of pre-86 weapons, machine guns, that were available. There's roughly only around 180,000 in circulation, I think, now, that people are actually, you know, registered with. So now an average M16 machine gun costs about $25,000 for a civilian to buy a pre-86 one, whereas, you know, a sheriff's department or military law enforcement can buy a brand new one manufactured this year for about $1,200. And so what it basically did is that, again, was an overall ban on the weapons, even though they didn't call it a ban. So that's already happened with machine guns. Now, the second step in this is mandatory government buyback. Now, it generally starts out with buybacks, like we've seen, but most times they're just regular buybacks. They're unsuccessful with reducing crime, mainly because, you know, thugs that have pistols on them aren't really eager to trade their piece in for, you know, a $100 Best Buy gift certificate. They'll just keep their illegal pistol. So, but none of these buybacks that we've seen in the United States have ever been completely mandatory. You know, they had the one up in Connecticut a while back, but I think there were a lot of ways to get around that. Now, recently, what we've heard from old Hillary Clinton is that she wants to change that, She said she wants to take a page from Australia's gun control playbook and institute a national mandatory gun buyback, just like Australia did, which forced all gun owners to turn in certain firearms. Now, what was interesting about this, it was the exact same thing that we've seen here in the United States. There was a mass shooting in Port Arthur in 1996, you can look it up, and right after that, the Australian government enacted the National Firearms Agreement, which banned all semi-automatic rifles, all semi-automatic or pump-action shotguns, as well as other specific rifles and handguns. Now, they could either turn in their guns and receive a little bit of money for them, or keep their guns and become outlaws. And in the entire country of Australia, which, I mean, you know, Australia's, it's a nice size, but I mean, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of people don't live in specific areas of it, but the whole country, they ended up having 640,000 firearms bought back and destroyed, which was, I mean, it was ridiculous. It proved nothing. And I've talked about this before, you know, there's a YouTube video you can watch, and it goes into detail in 1987, 1988, you know, a few years after this firearms agreement and all these weapons were destroyed, and they were saying that before 1986, there wasn't even a statistical number for home invasions. The term really didn't even exist. In 1997, it went up to like 1,400 home invasions the first year. Then it like doubled the next year after that, because all the criminals now knew, even if they didn't have a weapon or a firearm, so to speak, they knew the owner of the house didn't have a firearm. So picking up a crowbar, baseball bat, knife, samurai sword, whatever you want to pick, you pretty much are going to have the advantage on an unsuspecting homeowner because they don't have a weapon anymore. You know, most homeowners don't have baseball bats and swords sitting in their house. So it really massively increased the entire amount of criminal activity in Australia. Now, the third step in this is a gun-grabbing task force. And this is what a lot of people refer to as confiscation. Door-to-door knocks, search raids, taking all the weapons. That's something that's pretty serious. It's pretty egregious. It definitely completely goes against our Constitution, the Second Amendment. But believe it or not, California already has its own gun-grabbing task force of 33 agents. Special op agents that are dedicated to confiscating firearms from individuals. Following the Senate bill in Senate Bill 950 in 2001, the Golden State created the Armed and Prohibited Persons System. Now, again, this is in 2001, as I mentioned before. The same thing after the 9/11 when we had the Patriot Act. 2001 was just, I mean, it was an interesting year for America. It was a year that we saw a serious attack on the United States, whether it was, you know, from an outside source or false flag. I don't know if anybody will ever get the real truth on that. But it was a year that we pretty much lost our entire liberties in the United States. The Constitution was essentially shredded. When the Patriot Act went into law, it pretty much granted the government full access to anybody in the United States under anything, as long as they said he could be a terrorist. Doesn't matter what they were doing, what they were involved in. All they had to use was the T word. They used the T word, it was completely on. They could do pretty much anything they want to you. And so what's interesting is in 2001, the Senate bill in California got passed, and it's a program that law enforcement uses to cross-reference registered gun owners with a list of individuals prohibited from possessing a firearm. So in theory, not a bad idea. The government can actively disarm bad guys or mentally ill, crazy people that shouldn't have weapons. Okay, that's a cool idea. But again, it doesn't always work out that way, especially when the state keeps lowering the bar for what makes one a prohibited person. And what's really, this one got me. I didn't even know about this until recently. Back in February 2003, there was a man named Michael Merritt in Bakersfield, California. He basically had this task force do a no-knock search warrant raid on his house, and they told him they were there to confiscate all of his firearms. And he's like, well, I don't know, this must be a mistake. And they told him, they said, no, you have a felony here from 1970. Yes, I said that right, 1970, a pot possession charge in 1970. Here's the kicker. the agents not only took his five registered handguns, they took his wife's handgun as well. And what's crazy is Merritt goes on in this article, he had already settled the matter in 1971 by paying a $100 fine, serving a probation stint, and had the felony charge reduced to a misdemeanor. This is already done. This is 40 years ago. Completely done. Over with. He had a pot charge. Give me a break. In California, of all places. That's what I like. A pot charge. And it was a felony pot charge. Got it dropped, paid the fine, did his probation, went on his way. 40 years later, he gets a no-knock search warrant, raiding his house, telling him they're confiscating all his weapons. Now, he was able to get an attorney. He settled the situation. And basically, the police department finally returned Merritt's property to him. And if you guys know, I told you guys yesterday on the show about the shotgun incident I had when I was 19. And trying to get the weapon back from the police department is just, it's a nightmare. I mentioned Atlanta now is holding 10,000 confiscated weapons that they're refusing to even give back to people that didn't commit any crimes or got adjudicated or they were found not guilty. And you got to understand, California is really just the beta test for this right now. It happens over there. People say, oh, it's in California. You know, we're in Florida. It's a long ways away. No, man. Every state is all connected. Remember, we're all bunched together here. It's not like we're our own, you know, countries. California is a beta test for this. They're seeing what they can get away with. In my opinion, and this is just my opinion, I really don't think that they made a mistake confiscating that guy's weapon. Because anything that got expunged from the 70s and got transferred down to a misdemeanor, first off, that stuff's not even in computer database anymore. All that stuff's in paper files and folders in some storage unit from 40 years ago. So that stuff's not even in the system anymore. So you're telling me they were digging through paperwork 40 years ago and happened to pull his record and say, oh, it was a felony. Oh, we don't see any other paperwork that's stapled with it that shows that it's a misdemeanor. We're going to go take his weapons. No, I think they do this intentionally to see what they can get away with. And this guy at least had enough brains to get an attorney and say, hey, I want my stuff back. You guys are a bunch of idiots. But this type of task force confiscation program, I think it's going to be expanded in the future. Now, when and where, I don't know. Hopefully none of our politicians are at least bought and paid for enough to even go along with this type of egregious behavior. But what I go on to say after that is Wisconsin lawmakers now are introducing confiscatory gun bill. Lisa Subek, complete and total idiot, along with Teresa Berkue, Melissa Sargent, and Chris Taylor, which all of them, I mean, well, you already know how I feel about that. They've all supported the confiscation bill that could, if passed, would turn law-abiding gun owners into felons. Here's how the bill actually reads verbatim. This bill bans the transportation, purchase, possession, or transfer of a semi-automatic assault weapon. Notice how they always say assault weapons, which technically the definition of assault weapon is included as a variant of a three-round burst or fully automatic weapon. These semi-automatic sporting rifles that they call assault weapons really aren't assault weapons, but that's what they call them now to make them sound scarier. The truth about it is the whole entire concept of the word assault weapon, if you look it up, I mean, assault is basically something you're inflicting harm or trying to hurt somebody in a weapon, meaning a baseball bat is a baseball bat. If you hit somebody in the head and knock them out and intentionally trying to hurt them, that would still be classified as an assault weapon. You assaulted that person with that weapon. So this term that they like to throw around, it's just obfuscation. They try to make it sound scary, but the real true definition when you look at this stuff are military three-round burst or fully automatic machine guns. Assault weapons is just this ridiculous word they like to come up with now. Make it sound scary. Anyways, back here we are. It specifically defines assault weapon for the purpose of the ban. Under the bill, whoever transport, purchases, possesses, or transfers a semi-automatic assault weapon is guilty of a felony and may be fined up to $10,000 and serve a term of imprisonment for up to 6 years. they aren't even telling anybody that this is, you know, a misdemeanor to have this, or we're doing a ban on it. You can keep it, but it's banned. You can't buy them anymore. And remember, this is Wisconsin. Wait a minute. FBI report in Wisconsin shows that there were only 80 gun-related murders in 2011. Oh, okay. So the crime in Wisconsin's really, really, really low with firearms. That's interesting. Oh, so anyways, yes. So you read that correctly. The only option that it gives these people, since we, you know, we're just riddled with gun murders in Wisconsin, we're up to 80 people now in 2011. You either get rid of the prohibited firearm, or you maintain possession of the firearm and run a risk of being a felon. Now, the good news on this is that we have enough grassroots people at stuff like Guns America and many advocates for Second Amendment, and Subek and her cohorts have now decided, updated, I think it was yesterday, to reassess their plan to ban modern sport rifles in Wisconsin. She states, while LRB 3635 was not intended to impair Wisconsin's rich hunting heritage and those who annually participate in it, our state does need to have a serious and meaningful conversation about gun violence. Whatever. The thing you got to look at about this is all they ever want to show you are the gun violence. They never show you what the guns do to prevent more violence. Sometimes guns are the only option to prevent more violent behavior from happening. That's just part of it. The same way it was with spears and swords back in the Roman time. Swords were a deterrent from more violence. If somebody had a sword and somebody's walking down the street that didn't have a sword, that person with a sword had an advantage over him to rob him. That's the way it's been. That's the way it will always be. Regardless of the weapon, there's always a reason for it. And what's crazy is another story, as I was just mentioning, one bad guy is dead and has been arrested after a 13-year-old boy used his mother's firearm. I like this kid, 13 years old. This is great. He thwarted a home invasion at his house. Authorities say around 2 p.m., 31-year-old Lamar Brown and 28-year-old Ira Bennett attempted to break into the teen's house in Woodside, South Carolina. Fearing for his safety, the boy grabbed his mother's Colt 1911 45 pistol and opened fire on the suspects. So this kid's 13 years old, and he's running a 1911. I mean, that's pretty impressive. I mean, that's a nice-sized handgun. Big caliber, too. Good caliber. It's funny, because it says he saw the subjects trying to break into the back door and the window, and as they were starting to get through the door, he fired his mother's gun through the door, and the subject reportedly fired back, which means the guy that was breaking into the house had a handgun on him, which means he more than likely had intent to do deadly harm or serious harm to the occupants, because A, the firearm was in his possession in basically the act of a robbery, and secondly, he had it loaded, because as soon as this kid shot through the door, the 1911, the suspect returned fire through the door, which means he was ready to shoot anybody when he came in the house. That's how serious these incidences are when you get these criminals that have these stolen pistols. The only thing that would have deterred this guy from breaking into this house with a handgun was another handgun. Nobody ever understands that. This 13-year-old boy probably either would have been severely beaten or killed if these people would have gotten in the house. But, I mean, luckily his mom taught him how to shoot a pistol, and he ran a 1911 like a champ. It says after the exchange of gunfire, the suspects fled to the hospital. Brown sustained 3 gunshot wounds, which proved to be fatal. The kid killed him. 3.45 caliber rounds through the door, still killed him. Perfect. And Bennett told the hospital staff that they had been victims of a random shooting. And, of course, the story didn't hold up. As soon as the calls came in for the home invasion and everything else, they immediately took the other person into custody because the one guy was already dead. And, again, like I was mentioning before, hopefully the story makes headlines. I doubt it will because they don't like to put anything positive about firearms in headlines. But in most instances, defensive guns usually go unreported by the mainstream media. When good guys with guns eliminate scumbags with guns, it's not usually newsworthy. That's just the sad part of it. Anytime a gun-toting criminal, you know, tries to take an illegal gun and commit, you know, kill somebody, like shoot up a movie theater, which, you know, we already know that was probably a false flag in Aurora. pretty interesting. But even other stuff, and robberies and shootings, they always get ink. They always get a narrative about how evil guns are and how woefully lax our gun laws are. So this story with this 13-year-old kid running the 1911 through the door probably won't get any traction at all. So sad as that is, but it's just part of it. Oh, now on some health stuff for you guys. I know you guys always enjoy all the health stuff. We have a new... There's new pharmaceuticals basically being introduced every year. We know that. There's just a plethora of them all the time. And there's even ones now for nonsensical diagnoses. And I love this. There's pharmaceutical drugs now for mathematics disorder, intermittent explosive disorder, oppositional defiance disorder, orthorexia nervosa, which is healthy eating. Okay. Now, the World Health Organization, which we know how, you know, clean and non-corrupt they are, they have a new classifying thing out now. They're trying to basically create aging as a disease by 2018 so they can make a drug for aging, which is great. While the notion of whether aging itself is a disease is usually disputed, classifying it as such will help shift the focus of biomedicine from treatment to prevention, says Alex Zarkoff, PhD of Insilico Medicine. And what's crazy about this is that there already is something for healthy aging. We know healthy diet, exercise, proper water intake, and good key supplements like COQ10, Ultimate Multiple, cod liver oil. All these things do wonders for health. But, of course, you can't leave it up to anybody in the pharmaceutical industry to not try and make a medication for any type of just any disease that pops up that they want to call a disease. Now, a pretty crazy one that's actually really interesting that I get calls on all the time is antibiotics. So I want you guys to listen to this, man. Antibiotics should only be used in rare circumstances if they're mandatory. I've told people that before. Way too many people go on antibiotics for nothing, and we're creating these super bugs. But now this new report of two joint trials outside of the University of Amsterdam took two randomized placebo-controlled trials of healthy people. A single course of oral antibiotics altered the composition and diversity of gut microbial for months, and in some cases up to a year. This is interesting. Gut microbial diversity was significantly altered by all four kinds of antibiotics, which lasted months. In participants that took, let's see how this one is, ciprofloxacin, the diversity, which basically the overall gut health, was altered up to 12 months. The antibiotic treatments also caused a spike in genes associated with antibiotic resistance, which I was referring to earlier as the superbugs that we're creating. Also, the researchers noticed that it killed off microbes that produce butyrate, a short-chain fatty acid that inhibit inflammation and oxidative stress in the gut. So not only do these, you know, antibiotics completely kill off all the healthy flora, good bacteria, everything that's in the colon, they completely ruin everything and increase oxidative stress and inflammation in the gut. So I tell people, you know, if you start getting sick, man, hit the excellent C. The Virographis, the D3. You know, we have a kit on our website. We put together, it's worked for hundreds of patients. It's a healthy immune support kit. It's an awesome kit. You don't need antibiotics all the time. Now, granted, like I said, they are there for good things. When there's specific infections that are really severe, they're awesome. Antibiotics work great for that. But just taking them because you got a little sinus infection or you get sick or you get a two-day flu bug, no, man, there's too much other stuff. And if you do have to run antibiotics, make sure you take either the probiotics, ProbioMax 100 billion, or the probiotic blend that we have. The ProbioMax 100 is pretty much one of the strongest probiotics you can get on the market. We have a company make it for us out of Orlando. It's 100 billion CFU, which stands for colony-forming units of probiotics per capsule and sealed nitrogen-sealed blister packs. Really, really serious compound. On the other news as well, Hawaii has now allowed to test fields of GM bananas, as sad as that is. The Hawaii State Department of Agriculture conducted an impromptu meeting to allow biotech to field test genetically modified bananas. This is a great concern to the people of Hawaii, and no public notice was made at the meeting. University of Hawaii received a $1.5 million research grant, and we talked about this a couple days ago, about how these research grants are used to control everything and get the, basically the approval of scientists and doctors and professors from the U.S. federal government to develop a GMO banana variety, even though Hawaiian residents have made it very clear they oppose GMO crops. Now, I have no idea why they always want to make GMO everything. Last time I checked, you know, bananas down from South America and from Hawaii weren't having too many issues. I know they had some stuff with the, I think, bunchy top virus or something they had in Hawaii. But it goes on to say research needs to be conducted to determine potential health, environmental, economic, and social impacts from the release of a GMO banana in Hawaii. Yet the biotech industry is set to enlist this GMO banana variety without any of it. Little to no research has been conducted by the University of Hawaii to find alternative, ecologically based, low-input practices to try and manage any type of issues on bananas, including the bunchy top virus that apparently has become an issue over there some. Now, the next one, now we can leave it up to the FDA to always do great stuff for us. Turmeric, you know, Ted and I are huge proponents of turmeric. It basically is the curcumin is the main ingredient in turmeric, which has significantly awesome properties. You know, we use the turmeric force in our blood sugar protocol. We use it in our inflammation kits. It's great. It's great for blood sugar. It's great for the immune system. It's great for inflammation. It's great all across the board. From a health standpoint, it's honestly, it's almost a miracle. It can do really crazy stuff. Naturally, the drug industry wishes it could patent it as a drug, but that cannot happen because natural foods generally cannot be patented. FDA, though, has just ruled that curcumin cannot be used in a compounded medication. Compounded medication is basically prepared just for you by a specialized pharmacy. A lot of times they do it with hormone replacement therapy, specific things like that. Now, the turmeric, curcumin, from a natural approach, there's not really anything they can do to ban that. But I just find it funny that a compounding pharmacy that somebody may be using turmeric with to really help with something they have going on, it's banned now. They can't use it. Compounding pharmacies are completely banned from using curcumin at all in any of their compounding formulas. And the thing about it is, there's never been one negative link derived from turmeric. It doesn't do anything negative. Their only side effects are positive. Everything it does is good for you, but yet they're banning it compounding pharmacies. So it just goes to show you that they have absolutely no care about what's going on. Now, some other news. You know, we've been trying to keep everybody reported up on everything that's been going on with Germany, the invasion over there, the Islamic and Sharia law, and all the looting and robbing and everything that's been going on. Ted's going to be flying over there again. Or not again, well, he goes over there every now and then. He'll be going over there to do, actually, for a missions trip, to be interviewing some people over there and seeing some family here shortly. So that should be interesting to see how a lot of that goes over there. What's also funny is Department of Homeland Security has spent more than $1 billion in taxpayer money to digitize immigration paperwork. Okay, so they're trying to make immigration, you know, more exact, more solid, and provide, you know, positive things for it. Well, after a decade of work, they have managed to put up one document online. The Washington Post reported Monday that officials at the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services still are only able to offer a single form out of nearly 100 needed for online applications, and they can still only make a single fee payable electronically. All other forms have to be filed with paper. I just find that funny because obviously it's not a priority. One thing that's really that kind of irked me today is I got an email today with all these videos in the Netherlands, and these people are interviewing these migrants. And what happened apparently yesterday is that migrants in the Netherlands, they've been complaining about, you know, slow internet and stuff like that, which I don't even, you know, slow internet. Okay, you're getting internet as migrants, as refugees. I mean, that in itself is awesome. Now they are sleeping out on the streets this week in protest for not having televisions in all of their rooms. This is nuts. You can't even make this up. They're on video yelling and sleeping in the middle of the streets over it, mad, angry they don't have TVs in their rooms. According to the report by NOS.nl, the migrants are being housed in the former Ministry of Social Affairs and Employment, but they are not happy with the lack of entertainment being provided by the government. Syrian refugees, who would presumably be grateful to escape war and ISIS persecution, they basically now are complaining about the lack of TV. Now, here's the thing you have to understand about this. You just got to go to a country with free everything for you. You have no job. You have nothing to produce. You can't offer anything positive for society. You're basically sucking money from the country. And you're not getting bombed. You're not getting shot at. You're not getting mortared. You're in complete safety and complete comfortability with free everything. And you're protesting about TVs, which leads me to believe that these guys were not in war zone areas. A lot of these guys were in very, very good, healthy areas of the Middle East, and they're still not happy with their free stuff they're getting because they're not getting enough. So there's more to all these people that are coming in there, a lot more. Granted, you know, we do have some serious true asylum seekers that are coming from, you know, the war-torn areas where the water's, you know, completely polluted, bombed out. We understand that, and I completely understand helping these people out. But a lot of these people are not that. Obviously, they don't even care about being out of their own country. They're mad that they don't have free TV. And it goes on to say they've been complaining about the food being the same every day, as much as the rooms being too small, and they're also filmed complaining about slow Wi-Fi connections, about being bored, having to eat average foods, and the authorities not handing them enough money to buy cigarettes. I can't help not laugh on that one. So they're mad that they're not getting free money to buy tobacco products. That's what these people are coming to this country for. Free tobacco, free TV, free Wi-Fi, free housing. it's funny to me. And what's even worse now is their proposed German law that they the Senate Chancellery has actually proposed altering German law, which currently forbids police from entering a home against the owner's permission without a warrant. The proposal would add a paragraph to 36 SOG. The regulatory authorities and the police can enter to check the suitability for accommodations of refugees' land, building, or parts thereof without the consent of the owner, if the threat for the prevention homelessness is required. So they're basically saying they're going to give the police full power and autonomy to bust in people's homes without their permission to conduct suitability checks to see if the accommodations could be used for asylum seekers. And, I mean, it just keeps getting crazier and crazier. Some German citizens who live in social housings have actually been given eviction notices in order to make way for more of these invaders. The migrants are also being housed in four-star hotels and upscale churches. Last month, regional government told residents of a municipality in Germany that if they didn't embrace the arrival of hundreds of new migrants into their tiny town, they should leave. You should leave. You should just leave your own country. You don't need to live here. The migrants deserve it more than you. I guess that's their ideology behind it. As reported earlier this week, a German member of parliament also called for introducing a compulsory labor program under which young Germans would be forced to spend a year in service to the migrants. And this isn't just happening, you know, over there. We see it. I mean, as far as the invasion's horrible, but, I mean, if you look up there in on the outskirts of Detroit in Hamtramck, you find some crazy stuff. It was the outskirts known since the 20s as a thriving Polish community, a lot of times known as Pole Town by Detroiters and people from Michigan for its bustling district of Polish restaurants, markets, Catholic churches. Now, you can't even find a butcher shop that offers Polish sausages or any meat that's not basically blessed as the halal meats left by an imam, whatever they are. The sound of church bells is given away to the chants of Muslim holy men giving the call to prayer in Arabic. Many of the storefronts have been converted to mosque, and the call to prayer is blasted over loudspeakers 5 times a day. Some critics in the neighboring communities call it Shariaville. And it's getting out of control. There's also another city of Sterling Heights, about 14 miles north, was also having a massive issue with it. It's getting worse up there, too, because they spread. Sterling Heights' plan, though, however, voted 9-0 on rejecting plans for a mega mosque. And so that was a win for them. They wanted to basically put a mega mosque in tiny little Sterling Heights. And it was voted 9-0. But this is getting out of control. I mean, the problem is, with one family that's Islamic, by their own admission, they have 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 kids in the family. So, I mean, they're breeding and reproducing 4 and 5 times faster than anyone else in society. The problem with this is, how do you pay for this many kids? How can you possibly afford to birth, house, clothe, feed, educate that many kids? Government subsidies is the only answer to that. And, you know, we tell them, hey, come here, you get free housing, free benefits, free Medicare. No wonder there's basically almost over 10 plus more kids per family. Even what I discussed yesterday, the welfare immigration papers are now offered in 14 different languages. So we're not even trying to make them comply with us or accommodate our culture. We're completely catering to them. And that's what we're doing with all these social welfare programs with them. I mean, we're giving them all this free stuff. I mean, unless you make a substantial amount of money, you cannot afford to have 10 kids, period. That's why Americans, on average now, we've completely slowed down. We're usually having 1 or 2 kids per family because we actually have to work for our money. We actually pay a substantial amount of money in taxes taxes that go to pay these guys free subsidies because they don't want to work. And it's interesting when you start looking at all this, and now we got them over in the Netherlands complaining because their free Wi-Fi is slow, and they don't have enough free TVs and free money for cigarettes, and so they're protesting and sleeping in the middle of the street. So I'm pretty excited next week to see in a couple weeks what's happening over there live from Ted when he gets over there, and really report back and let everybody know what's going on. Because this is a serious problem, guys. We definitely need to stand strong with it, not fall to the political correctness, not be all complacent and allow them to just run everybody over. We have to start standing up for this. And, I mean, if you don't think so, then you just need to watch some of the videos online. I mean, it'll wake you up real quick when you see how these people are acting and what they're doing over there. They're not here to be friends. They're not here to enjoy the population. They're there to try and take over. So, I hope you guys enjoyed the show today by myself. Hope I didn't rant too much for you. If you guys need anything, give us a call. The show's brought to you by healthmasters.com. We have some of the finest supplements in the world. Give us a call or check out our website, healthmasters.com. Let us know if you need anything. Ted will be tonight on Hagman from 7 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. Hope you guys enjoy it. Have a great weekend.
On Facebook, on the news, and in conversations with friends, we're bombarded every day with advice on how to be healthier, from gluten-free and non-GMO diets to how much exercise and sleep the body needs. But how much have you heard about alkalizing the body?